Today is a very special day because it's episode 50, and we're going to look back and think about some of the reflections that I have from starting Student Loan Planner right about 3 years ago today. First, I want to start off with this kind of milestone episode with reminding why it is we do what we do. So we're going to take a listener question from studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. So remember that you can go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail and ask your own questions, and we'll answer them for free here on the show if we think it's an interesting question. So first, we've got a question from Alex, who's a dentist.
Hey, Travis, had a question. If I own a practice and I'm on income-based relief, how does that get calculated? Looking to buy a practice, so I'm not very sure, but as an employee, I pay my income-based relief based on my biweekly check or annual income. But if my practice is grossing, let's say, $1 million, but I pay myself $150,000, would the $150,000 as my salary count towards the student loans, or would you take into account dividends or the money, the profit, which I'd also be taking? Or how is that calculated, and is there a way I could kind of shield some of that money to keep my income-based relief lower so that my monthly payment is still lower if I'm paying myself a salary out of the total gross profit out of the company?
Basically, what is being asked there is a lot of people who own their own businesses have to set a wage to pay themselves. So this is because of something called an S corporation. Basically, an S corporation is a way to legally pay less in taxes. Basically, you set some artificial wage that your accountant says is legitimate for your business to pay you, and then the rest of the profits you make from the business, you distribute them. So that allows you to avoid some self-employment taxes and employment taxes from Social Security and Medicare tax especially. And so the question is say that you make $400,000 in your business, but your wage is $100,000. Could you potentially just say, well, I'm just going to pay 10% or 15% under an income-based plan on my $100,000 salary, $100,000 wage, or do I have to pay 10% of $400,000? Unfortunately, under today's rules, it's extremely clear that you have to pay based off of your total income, AGI, adjusted gross income. And what is that? Everything that flows through from your business income, you know, is going to be in that in terms of what needs to be counted in your student loan payment. It's very, very clear on the income-driven certification form. You can read this yourself if you want, that you have to include all sources of bonuses, business income, dividends, interest, everything is supposed to be included in what that percentage is supposed to be of. So that means that unfortunately, yes, you do need to include all your profits. And it is your profit. It's not your gross revenue or something. So you don't have to pay, you know, 10% of your revenues. That'd be really terrible. So there are ways to reduce what that percentage is in terms of what you have to pay. So the best way to do that is just to put money away into things that grow your wealth while reducing your taxable income. So examples of that is things like real estate, where you can write off the value of buildings and you know, improvements that you do. You can write off retirement savings. You can write off self-funded pension plans if you're making like over $400,000 a year. There's all kinds of write-offs that you can do to reduce your income-driven repayment. So really good question from Alex. So let me take you back in time on the journey of starting this thing called Student Loan Planner. It was about 2015, and I had decided that I was going to quit my job as a bond trader and travel the world. And when I least expected it, I met my now wife, and we started dating, and we started dating at like the worst time because I had been planning this trip around the world for a long time because I felt like I wasn't a corporate person, and I just wanted to go and travel the world and see the world. And I even considered myself early retired. In fact, if you go on Amazon and type my name in, you can see a really bizarre book called 25 is the New 65, which is basically my tome, my pamphlet on what I thought was this revolutionary idea that people in their 20s should think about retiring early. With the benefit of maturity and hindsight, I realized what that really was just basically a sabbatical to do something that I felt more called to. During that time, I was really interested in student loans just because the person I was dating, my now wife, she had a lot of student loan debt for medical school. I thought, well, I'm pretty good at Excel being a bond trader. This is what I did at work all day. So let me go and make a model and see how we can best get out of debt. So I did this, and then I realized that more people besides just my girlfriend needed that help. A lot of her friends, when she started saying, hey, Travis helped me figure out my loans, he can help you too, she suggested, and I have to really give her credit, that I charge for that advice. So for you listening out there, if you have something that you're really good at, consider charging for it. You'll find out really quickly whether or not that's a viable business idea, because a good business idea is something that you can guilt-free ask your friends to pay you for because it's that good. You don't even have to feel like you have to give it away for free because that's how valuable it is. That's where I really realized I was onto something with the business. And so that's what I would think about for something that you're doing, right? If you are that good of a fill-in-the-blank lawyer, dentist, physician, something like that, then people should pay you for your expertise, and you would want to be really, really good at it so you feel good about your friends and family telling people about you, right? So think about that for your own life. In terms of one of the couple first consults that I did, it was like a physician in New York who was an acquaintance of my wife for med school, and she was so desperate for help. She just was willing to talk to anybody to get help with managing her loan payments because they were so high, and she had childcare, she had rent that was really expensive, she had went through a really difficult personal situation, and it was just very, very tough for her to make ends meet with the amount of debt that she had. You know, back then my rate was a fraction of what it is today. That's another suggestion that I have for you is when you want to build something, a business or practice or even your career, give away what you can do for way less than what it's worth. And what happens is when you do that, people want to tell everybody about it, right? Think about the last time you went out and had the best pizza in the world for $5, or let me rephrase that. For people who don't eat pizza, the best salad in the world for $5, right? Like you told everybody about that because it was so good. And what happens sometimes when you think about when restaurants get bad, like how do they get bad? Well, you know, they get that amazingly low intro price and get a lot of good reviews on Google, and then they raise their prices, and then people don't think that they're getting value for what they're paying. So hopefully that never happens to us. Hopefully you never end up feeling that way about Student Loan Planner. But if you do, let me know. What's interesting is these first few consults that I did, there wasn't a process back then. There wasn't any body of knowledge that I'd gained from doing thousands of plans. So a lot of it, I was having to research stuff just on my own. I was looking up FAQs under income-driven repayment stuff on the federal website, doing a lot of research, doing a lot of writing, which forced me to really think through these issues. And it was the Wild West too, because they had just changed some of the major income-driven repayment programs like revised pay-as-you-earn and things like that. And there was also a ton, even more scammers back then than there are today. I don't know really why this is the case, but it just seems like a lot of these student loan scammers have just now been starting to get reeled in by the Federal Trade Commission. So if you think about, I saw one today, this group of people built people out of $71 million. Holy cow, man. I mean, sometimes I get nervous like, oh, you know, is this too much of a price to charge for help or something? And then I see something like people giving absolutely no help at all, charging a multiple of what we charge, and then actually not even giving people plans. And obviously, I mean, in my opinion, they're doing stuff that should be criminal, but so hopefully, you know, that's not our comparison. But still, it's just so crazy to me that like how crazy it was back then in 2015, 2016 when I was getting started. Just all kinds of ads on the radio. I saw somebody I went to college with who was an actor, like struggling to make money, like was super hyping up loan forgiveness programs on social media that he didn't know about that were actually, you know, ripping people off. It was a really interesting time. And I can't say that I was sure that it was going to be successful and we were going to be able to help you and help other people and help thousands of people with their loans. I want to share today a few things that I learned from creating this to the extent that this is a successful business. I think that there are some lessons that will be really interesting for you in your own life and just cool stories that I think that will be entertaining, which is why I'm sharing them, right? We've now advised about 750 million in student loan debt for about 3,000 clients. And I don't take that lightly. And there's some really interesting lessons in that. So hopefully you'll be entertained today. So first thing I've learned, some schools are honest in the way that they deal with people. And some schools are downright profit hungry, corporate. I don't care. We want to make money, 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 money. And that's what they think about. Here's just some examples, okay? All you can ask is for a school to be upfront and honest with you. And I've learned that schools are like people because different schools have different cultures and different people that run different schools have different ways of doing things. And some are very aggressive and others are pretty transparent. I'll just give you kind of an anecdotal story here at the risk of getting in trouble. So I have read a very large difference in the way that our readers have said that USC Dental School and NYU Dental School deal with prospective students. I've heard plenty of USC dental graduates tell me that USC always said the school was going to be super expensive. They always said that we were probably going to have to use income-driven repayment. You know, our financial aid director told us that like it was probably a long shot that we were going to pay this off directly, that we probably would need to use income-driven payment. Maybe until recently, I don't know if they've changed, I heard the exact opposite for most of our clients that went to NYU, that the top level administration there were making promises about how fast they were paying their loans off in mathematically impossibly short periods of time. They were talking about, you know, the standard sort of boilerplate, this is the best time ever to be a dentist, you're going to make so much money and all these things. I mean, that's just kind of like a difference between a school that's transparent and one that's not. And there's a lot of examples of this. You know, we recently tried to do an article about the cheapest physical therapy schools. And I think it's fine to share this. We reached out to the body that's in charge of accrediting physical therapy schools, the Commission for the Accreditation of Physical Therapy Education. We made a request for their data because they said online that you could request it. So we're like, okay, we're a public interest organization that would like to request the data so we can report on that data so that we can help people decide if they should go to physical therapy school and where are the best deals. But this organization refused to release the data. And why is this? With the benefit of some knowledge and some wisdom from having done this for the past 3 years, the different institutions and higher education organizations that exist really, in a lot of cases, just back up whoever's funding them, wherever the money is. You know that old story of follow the money? Well, with a lot of these accreditation bodies, all you have to do is follow the money to figure out why they're doing what they're doing. And so it is a great idea for this organization that's responsible for accrediting schools to probably, I'm assuming, have as many schools as possible and have as much accreditation work to do as possible and be as big as possible, right? And the people that are going to be influencing who's running those organizations and the money that is available to that organization is probably mostly going to be the schools, not necessarily the students. And so transparency and accuracy and informing students to make a good decision for their financial future is not something that pays the bills for this organization, right? So that's why I think that they rejected our request for data, is they didn't want us to publish their members' costs of attendance and potentially embarrass those institutions and cost those institutions money. I just think it's really interesting that if you look at what are the incentives, you can really answer a lot of questions about why institutions behave the way they do. So another example of this, and this is across every profession, in every graduate profession. I was at this chiropractic conference and I heard a story that just kind of blew my mind. This guy said that his chiropractic school flew him into the campus to do a tour and they paid for it and they paid for the hotel, the flight, meals, everything. And he said, well, he felt like it was a good tour and it was a good idea, so he would just go there. And then I thought, oh my gosh, this guy has no idea the business reasons of why they're doing that, right? Or at least he is not wise to the scheme. And the scheme is simply, this is a business transaction. We're going to pay to fly in 100 people and 10 of them are going to say yes. And the cost to fly all these people in is, let's say, $10,000. And we know that one of these people who signs up is worth $100,000 or $200,000, right? And if we get 100 people and this conversion rate's 10%, and we would have gotten half as many people without this method, what this really is just, in my opinion, it's predatory. And I wonder if more and more schools, like pharmacy schools and other schools right now that are having trouble attracting students because they've over-created schools, they've created too many seats for the real demand that's out there, especially in the absence of unlimited student loan borrowing. I wonder if you're going to see more and more of these unethical recruiting tactics. It's one thing if a bunch of people are trying to recruit you and they're giving you a full tuition, full ride scholarship because you're a D1 athlete. But if you're a student that's going to be paying the school a ton of money, I think it should be illegal to pay for people's visits to come tour the campus and then ask them to take out tons and tons of debt to fork over to the school. I just think that that's just really wrong, but that's the world that we live in. And, you know, the stuff I see, I try to stay sober about it, but it really does shake your faith sometimes in humanity to see how people do things that just whatever pays the bills. I mean, certain institutions, certain organizations, it's really kind of like that. And you have to protect against that. And I'd like to think that we're going to be part of the solution and not part of the problem and helping protect you against things like that. And frankly, too, I hope that we maintain our independence. That's another thing that I would like to reflect on after 3 years of doing this is there are so many temptations, and we'll get in this later, but golly, could we do so much more business if we kept our mouth shut and we played nice with all the schools and we never said anything mean, and we want to try to be fair to the schools. Like, again, you know, there's a difference between saying, you know, you're going to have to pay 10 to 15% of your income. Loans are going to be like a tax. This is the system that exists. So it makes sense probably to trade 15% of your earnings for a dental degree that could pay you $200,000 a year compared to, you know, not losing 15% of your earnings and doing a corporate job making 50 a year with no student debt. I mean, that's probably a good trade. And so if schools are honest about that, I think that's fine. I mean, I think that's a reasonable, rational decision, and more power to those schools. And we'll try to praise those schools that are doing it that way. But there's just a lot of schools that are just not doing it the right way at all. And they're just, you know, not at all reflecting the noble esteem that we hold our institutions of higher education in. So I'm hoping that will change, but I don't know. I think that in reality, when the student loan bubble pops, and it will pop at some point, I think that, you know, most people are trying to do the right thing, just maybe operating under a terrible incentive structure. Some people are not doing the right thing. They just rationalize doing it the way they do it. And probably nobody's going to go to jail. So I think that's probably what it's going to happen when the student loan bubble pops. A couple of things that I've learned that are not just, you know, talking about just, you know, people doing things wrong, things that can actually help you, which is a good little shift here. Your three things that matter in personal finance that I have learned from doing thousands of plans in the past 3 years. You want to focus on your savings rate, making sure those savings are ending up in investments instead of just the bank, and also earning more money. Those are the three things that matter more than anything else with your personal finances. So here are a couple things that do not matter at all. How many lattes you buy? What is the ideal portfolio of stocks, bonds, real estate, small cap value, real estate investment trusts, municipal bonds, international bonds, emerging markets? Should you invest in Tesla or Apple? How do you get a good deal on your next vacation? What do you pay for your next mattress? All these things actually don't matter because they're small decisions in the grand scheme of things. What matters so much more than that is how much are you going to put away out of what you earn? And then are you just going to leave that in the bank where it's going to be giving you 1% or 2% interest and it's never going to grow? Or are you going to take long-term risk to have that money potentially free you from having to work? And the other thing that matters is the ability to earn more money. So I used to think that the only thing that mattered was savings rate. But if you're not making any money, then like the best advice I could give somebody is go get a higher hourly wage for what you're doing. Like if you're making $10 an hour and let's say that you want to send your kid to a private school and you want to live in a certain neighborhood, or you want to retire at 50 and you work, you know, in fast food, like the smartest thing to do is to use that fast food job to pay the bills, and with any extra money you possibly can, including student loan debt, borrow and get an employable degree that increases the value of your hourly wage and what you're worth on the market in terms of what the market will pay you. And so sometimes you have to focus on earning more money. And there's a lot of different ways you can earn more money. Sometimes you can simply earn more money by asking. all you have to do is just prove that you're worth more to your employer than what they're paying you. And if you can make a compelling data-driven argument, then a lot of times you'll get a big raise out of that. You just have to ask, but just ask in a way that's data-driven and not just ask, because just asking just honestly stresses out an employer. I can speak from that from experience. But if you ask with having specific data to back it up, that's how you're going to potentially get big raises, and that'll be pretty significant. So if you want to have a high savings rate, there's actually a really simple way to do it. And it's a little secret that I've learned, again, from 3 years of just talking about student loans all the time. Spend less on cars and houses. That's it, folks. Everything else doesn't really make that big of a difference. If you look at cars and houses, that's generally where 40 or 50% of your spending goes. If you tackle on all the maintenance costs, the insurance costs, a lot of the different fees that exist, like in Missouri, there's like a property tax on cars, property tax on houses. I mean, there's all these things you don't really think about. And it really eats up the majority in a lot of cases of our spending, and we don't even realize it. I rarely see big expenses outside of, obviously, if you're paying off your student loans, that could be a big expense. But, you know, excluding that, excluding cars and houses, pretty much everything else is really kind of a variable expense that you could turn off. Not everything, of course, but like a lot of this stuff truly is an expense that you could eliminate if you had to. You wouldn't want to eliminate it, but you could. You know, if you absolutely had to stop your insurance premiums or going out to eat or going on vacation, you could do that. If you had to stop buying clothes, if you had to stop your Amazon Prime membership, heaven forbid, you could do that, right? But it's really hard to get rid of your mortgage because that's a whole different level. So the best way to protect against that is drive paid off cars that are at least 2 or 3 years old that have significant miles on them that you buy, you know, in cash on Craigslist, and then buy houses that are 2 times your joint income or less. If you do that, you're going to have a really good savings rate. And it's really that simple. The reward for that is going to give you more funds to get financially independent sooner. Another thing I've learned, third tip I've got for you is that I think way more in terms of value now than in terms of cost. And being a business owner and running a business for the past 3 years has really showed me this. And so I'll give you an example. I've hired people in the past for $1,000 a month to do something, and they didn't do it. They didn't accomplish what I wanted at all. Then I paid $7,000 a month to do something, the very same thing, and this person knocked it out of the park and paid for themselves and then some in higher revenue for our business. That is really a fascinating comment. And the reason is because the $1,000 a month I spent was wasted money. The $7,000 a month I spent was fantastic money to spend. And that's because the $7,000 one actually did what they said they were going to do and could do it and had the skills to do it. Could I have predicted that ahead of time? Partly, yes, because the second employee had an excellent track record, reviews, and I knew other people that used them. So I had a lot of proof points to know that they were really, really good with their advice. So when you're a business owner, just keep that in mind. Is you want to be thinking in terms of cost. And obviously something that's cheap can have a ton of value. You know, we have a lot of cheap things that are some of the best money we spend. Like for me, like we have a website developer that's very affordable and he is really, really good and takes tons of stress off of me. And that's an enormous value, right? But a lot of times I think we spend money on things that are really not helpful. And in fact, we could maybe have a better result by actually spending more on it, which is kind of a weird thing that I would never have said that. If you talked to me a couple years ago, 3 years ago, I was super frugal. I would not spend any money on anything. And now I'll spend tens of thousands of dollars in a month on our business to try to bring this message to more people. And it's okay. I'm okay with it, which is something that's so interesting that it's allowed me to grow this thing. And I think that if you're interested in the entrepreneurial world, that's going to allow you to grow whatever you're doing too, is viewing your spending as if it's a business. And, you know, you don't have to view all of your spending as a business, obviously, but I think it's a helpful way to think about things. Because if you think about advice in your life, advice is not like buying a new car where the only thing that matters is like how good of a deal, how good of a price are you going to get? Because when you're doing something squishy like advice or just anything that's not a tangible physical good, the advice is either valuable or it's not. And some advice can be exponentially more valuable based off of how much that person or that institution or that that individual is an expert in giving it. So this is pretty true in education too. I just got done making a YouTube video. You know, we have a YouTube channel. If you type in Student Loan Planner, you'll find us. And I basically was just trying to talk about what the best cheap MBAs are. And I started thinking about it, and I found a lot of cheap MBAs for like $5,000 a year that were kind of regional public universities. And there's nothing wrong with that. But if you're a regional public university and you're going to take 2 years off from work to get that degree, that cheap degree probably doesn't have a ton of value because you're giving up a couple years of salary and all you're saving is a few thousand dollars a year compared to what could be a way, way higher value MBA program. So for example, like a flagship state university is probably going to have a much better product and a much better network for the price that you pay. And so there would be a much better value to go to the place that where you get a really good bang for your buck. Fourth little point that I wanted to highlight, fourth reflection after 3 years into student loans, what does the future look like for student loans? I get this question all the time. So I know there's going to be a lot of changes. I will say this, I'm extremely blessed in that I probably could survive if student loans were wiped out tomorrow. So if Bernie does win, I will be just fine. I would love a suggestion if you want an email podcast at studentloanplanner.com of what I should do if student loans all get forgiven. So clown school, join the circus, I don't know, give walking tours in St. Louis to tourists. Any ideas, feel free to share them. But this is what I feel called to deeply. And who knows what's going to happen with student loans, but I want to be here to help you through it. I think that's very important that this organization is there for you because I know that you have stress. I know that you have anxiety. Let's be real. You wouldn't be listening to a podcast about student loan debt if this didn't have a huge impact on your life psychologically. And I kind of want to be your person that's fighting this battle with you. And I want Student Loan Planner to be this organization that gives you a laugh about having to carry debt for 20 years. And I want Student Loan Planner to be a place where you can get free advice on a variety of topics and you can get guidance on how you can become financially independent a decade sooner. Because at the end of the day, you know, if you think about it, what's the difference between $10 million and $20 million or $1 million and $2 million? Yeah, there's a difference in the price tag, but what kind of impact did you have on somebody's life? I'm one of these people that some people, I guess, try to go for the biggest profit they can in business, and their charity is after they're done with their business. And I would like not, I wouldn't like this business to be a charity. That's, it's not, but I would like to have this business be a purpose, mission driven business where we're having an enormous impact on people's lives. We're going to do that as long as student loans are around. And if student loans go away, then our purpose will be fulfilled, I guess, and we'll have to come up with something else to do. I don't think that's probably going to happen, but I could very much see more generous repayment programs coming down the pipeline at some point. I think there could easily be capped borrowing amounts. If I had to bet, I would say probably more generous repayment plan terms, probably no tax bomb at some point, probably lower interest rates at some point, and you'll probably see more scrutiny on the institutions and on what they charge. So that would probably hit our business, and that's okay. I have to be okay with that because the reason this business exists is because I want to be useful and not just make money. That's not a good life to live, I think. Number five, reflection. People don't really understand that much about investing. It's kind of unbelievable because everybody thinks about investing in terms of getting the best return or getting the hot stock picked, right? Or how much in commissions am I paying on my, you know, discount brokerage account? No, like investing is important because it buys you time. And people don't put those two things together very well. People understand that when I buy a nice sweater, I feel warm and I feel better about myself and I get this dopamine hit. So that spending on that sweater was a good purchase. But nobody really, I think, intrinsically feels like putting money into an S&P 500 index fund is a good purchase. At least a lot of people don't feel that way because you don't make that connection between I'm putting money into this thing, which gives dividends, which replaces my income, which gives me time back in my life. And wow, people don't understand that. And I think a lot of people that are advised by financial advisors don't still understand that. You know, and so I just want to encourage you, the reason why you want to save and invest and grow your assets is because you get control of your time back. You might not know today what you would do with free time and more freedom over your life, but I guarantee that future you is going to know that they could do something with their time that they would like to do. So think about yourself 30 years from now. That's why you're investing. My sixth sort of takeaway from this 3 years of doing this, more people should take risks than are currently doing that. The only reason why I have this company that's grown to the level that it has is because I did something kind of stupid. I quit a perfectly good job that had great career prospects, and I traveled the world for a while without any plan whatsoever. And I've seen so many people and so many plans over the years that have just not gone for their dream. If you have a dream, go for it. If you want to start a business, if you want to start a practice, if you want to start a family, buy a house, whatever it is, take the risk. The biggest risk is not taking the risk. If you don't take the risk, you're exactly going to be in the spot you're in now, and you could have missed out on something that could change your life for the better in an enormous way and make life worth living. But so many people take the safe road. A lot of people, they take the path of being an employee, and that's fine if you want to do that. But a lot of people want to be their own boss, or they want to work part-time, or they want to retire at 50, or they want to have periods where they take time away from their career and go in and out of the workforce to have these sabbaticals like I did. And people are afraid, and they always talk themselves out of it. And I'm saying, don't talk yourself out of it. Student loan-wise, you're going to be fine. We can always show you ways to minimize or optimize the student loans where you can do anything you want to do. I think the biggest problem is more of a psychological hurdle. Like, people just don't feel like they can be practice owners. They don't feel like they can buy the house or whatever it is you want to do. And I just want to encourage you that you should do it. You know, a lot of times I like that one of my favorite questions to ask, especially dentists, is what do you think the default rate on dental practice loans is? Usually they say like 10, 20%. It's approximately 0.3% talking to bankers. So 3 in 1,000 dentists fail at their business. And apparently, I think out of the three that fail, I think two of them that failed, the bankers will say that it's because of substance problems, substance abuse problems. So basically, if you can stay away from the bottle and the pill box, you're going to be just fine as a dentist with your own practice. And, you know, that's an extreme example. And not every decision you make in life is that low risk. But I think that, you know, debt produces such anxiety because it makes you feel even less able to take those risks. So it makes you feel trapped. It makes you feel like you're not able to do what you want to do. And that creates a huge sense of discontent and fear. And I think that pain is what drives a lot of people to book our service, which is interesting. But I just want to encourage you, if you're listening to this, that whatever you're thinking about doing, you need to do it. Because for me, it ended up being a life-changing thing that I never could have predicted. And I think that that's what you'll experience if you take some risks is, yeah, bad things could happen, but the worst thing that can happen is usually definable, and there's a downside that you can quantify. And once you've defined what the downside risk is, then you can go ahead and go for it because you know what the worst thing that can happen is. And usually it's fear of failure, or fear about having other people see you fail. It's fear of, what if I have to declare bankruptcy? What if I lose my money? What if I'm not able to get a new job in the workforce? And a lot of these fears are just unfounded and irrational fears, and we have to get over them. Seventh thing that I like to reflect on is there's a lot of financial temptations now with this business that did not exist even a year or two ago. As this business has grown, we get pitched things all the time to promote. We have partnerships, some of which are extremely lucrative if you do certain things. And some of it's our own products. We have a huge incentive to tell people to refinance their student loans, take out a private student loan. And obviously, we have a big incentive to tell people to get a student loan plan. The product that we have, the student loan plan, I think that there's very little risk in telling somebody to do that, because from what I've seen, almost everybody needs one, because very, very few people truly understand all the nuances of this stuff. So I'm not too worried about that. But I am worried about things like telling people to refinance. Like, what if somebody refinances and there inevitably will be a couple where it's a terrible decision for them, because we are at this point refinancing a huge number of loans every month. And I think that the amount that people are probably refinancing through our company is probably in the 8 figures a year. I'm not really sure entirely. I don't have perfect reporting, but it's a huge number. in terms of how much people are refinancing through Student Loan Planner. And there will be some people that will be hurt from that at some point. And I think about that all the time. I am very, very worried that we will never be tempted by money to do something that's wrong, because that is basically why I went to work at Vanguard when I was a bond trader, is because I was extremely worried about ever being asked to do something that wasn't right. I don't know. I get very sensitive to that. I think a lot of people are like, that's the market price. You know, it is what it is. But I want to always do what's right. And if I'm not doing that, then I'd be really disappointed in myself and I'd be disappointing you. And that's what I'm really worried about. So I just hope that you can hold me to that standard. If you ever think I'm breaking that standard going forward, running this business, now that we're past the 3-year mark, please tell me. Send me a message if you think I'm doing something wrong, or I made a bad decision, or I let a conflict of interest cloud my judgment and how we're helping you. And just that feedback is just so valuable. And I really appreciate you, and I appreciate you trusting us to the extent that you do, where you're willing to listen to Student Loan Planner for help on your finances. It really does mean a lot. And it's humbling to get emails from people like you that have these very highly educated degrees and backgrounds, and you're clearly very smart, and then you're trusting us. It means a lot. It means that we're finally finding the point where our talent intersects the world's need. And that's something that I just really don't take for granted. I just want to tell you how much I appreciate that. You know, one thing I'm worried about too is student loan complexity benefits us. You know, so what about that accountant who wants taxes to be more complicated, because then they'll have more ways that they can make more money, right? I'm worried about that. I'm worried about being tempted about that. I'm worried, what if somebody comes to me as a student loan expert one day and I try to protect the system because it benefits me? That wouldn't be a good thing. You know, not for everybody that has used our services, and that's who my obligation is to, is our clients and our readers. So just thinking about that, I think that what will happen is if we offer help and we try to do the right thing, that it will work out. I think that, unfortunately, student loans are probably not going to become simple anytime soon. As long as the problem persists, people will appreciate us being around to help. So that's kind of the way I'm thinking the future will go with this business. And I fundamentally love helping you and your family, and I get such excitement out of having a positive impact in your life. And I hope you give me this chance to do this for at least another 3 years. You know, as long as I don't get hit by a bus, and as long as Bernie doesn't wipe it all out, I'm excited about this more than I ever have been. And now there is a big team behind delivering the help that you listen to weekly. And you know, when you read our site, there's close to 24 of us now. And not everybody is full-time. A lot of people have other things going on. But like, that's kind of cool that we're helping people. And I'm also able to help people through, you know, giving people an outlet for their talents where they're helping you. So it's just really neat. Like, if you've never started a business or you've never thought about it, I highly encourage it. I think, I mean, obviously businesses can be really stressful when they don't work out, but that's why you have the backup plan for what happens if the business fails. You just be honest with people, right? It's back to that earliest point that I made about schools that are honest versus schools that aren't honest. I tell my people all the time, you know, hey, if student loan forgiveness happens, then you all know that I have to let everybody go because our purpose is done. And they understand that. And I think that it's just a really cool, it's a cool feeling just to be able to help people while we're useful. So where do we think the future is going from here with this business? I would love to help 10 times as many people, because I am so confident that we can help them and that we have the best system to transform someone's life. That's the benefit of having done this thousands and thousands of times, is you figure out the kinks, you figure out what doesn't work, you figure out what works, and you understand the problem deeply psychologically with what people are going through, and then you're able to come up with better solutions as a result. So I am so excited that we are bringing on more people than we ever have. We have more consultants than we've ever had, and I guess just, you know, if you've already used our service, tell your friends about it. It's really very much appreciated. And if you haven't used our service yet, you know, just honestly, you can check out our reviews, and I think they speak for themselves in terms of what you're going to get out of this, and why it makes sense investing in advice that's valuable versus just trying to figure it out on your own, where the impact might not be there. So that's the last thought that I'll leave you with, is just, get help that's valuable and seek out things that are valuable and don't necessarily try to spend no money, because that can sometimes cost you way, way more than spending a little bit of money on something that will help you. And that's my thought. 3 years in, I don't know what I'll be feeling in the future, but thank you so much for the opportunity to serve you. And thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Thanks for listening to today's show. If you're ready to schedule your custom student loan plan, visit studentloanplanner.com/book and pick a time that works for you. The show notes are available at studentloanplanner.com/the number of today's episode. Finally, if you love your Student Loan Planner podcast, help us out and leave us a review or share it with someone who owes more than you.